Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
I've always wanted to do something great, like on the scale of a Greek hero, but I've never had like a Herculean-type body.
It's a new year, a new beginning, so what do you want to change? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
What's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
That's not it. That's not it at all.
This is working for me. I'm going to stick with it, baby.
Ooh, oh, there you go.
So funny.
I am a machine.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not going to have any more sodas.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine whether
to interrupt this task that is probably really important.
When do I get to survive?
If you could survive,
will you truly, at the end of that, you feel alive?
On today's show, a fresh start. We dissect our desires to start over, to do things better, and perhaps be healthier. But why is it so hard to stick to good intentions? Also, how did the slowest marathoner ever finish the race? And we follow a man on a long journey to getting a new liver. But first up, a network of doctors around the country is making an effort to tackle rare diseases. Some are so rare they haven't even been named yet. These doctors want to diagnose people who have complicated genetic disorders with the hope of figuring out how to treat them. Emily Seiner reports from WPLN in Nashville.
The Hall family lives on a farm in the middle of Tennessee. Today after school, Maggie Hall is helping feed the pigs and billy goats.
The pig with the pink feet is Bentley. The one that is solid black, the big one, is Mr. Wiggles.
Well, really, her dad, Mike, is doing most of the work.
The kids swear up and down they'll take care of them and feed them every day. And that lasts for 2 or 3 days, maybe?
I feed the cat.
Maggie is, in many ways, a standard 14-year-old. She likes bickering with her dad and baking Christmas cookies with her mom. But one evening, about 5 years ago, when Maggie was 8, her parents noticed some changes that didn't seem normal. Here's Mike.
We were just throwing the ball back and forth, and I noticed Maggie was having a lot of difficulty catching it. A little bit later that night, we were playing a game of Monopoly, and she couldn't find her game piece on the board.
It turned out Maggie was starting to go blind. They took her to a local doctor. No idea. Then they took her to doctors at Vanderbilt and Emory and Mayo Clinic. She was given test after test, but the doctors could not figure out what was happening, except that it was probably genetic. About a year and a half ago, it got worse, this time with her muscles. At one point, she could barely do physical activity.
We went on a trip out of town and had to bring her back in a wheelchair.
Doctors kept ruling out diseases. Mike says their guesses were getting more alarming. Multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy.
You know, we'd almost, you know, afraid of a diagnosis and you know, we're so afraid of bad news that it was almost like, well, they didn't find anything this time. Good.
But he says they really do want to know, why is this happening? That's the question doctors like John Newman are trying to solve, not just for Maggie, but for hundreds of patients around the country with rare genetic disorders.
They go from doctor to doctor and medical center to medical center, and sometimes the very best medical centers. And if it's a disease that no one has written about and knows, they get a different opinion at each place.
Newman works at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, which is one of 6 new sites in what's called the Undiagnosed Diseases Network. This is a $120 million program run by the National Institutes of Health. The goal is to get doctors at teaching hospitals around the country, in Boston, Los Angeles, Houston, and others, to collaborate and share information. The process starts with something that seems mundane: paperwork. Patients send in inches or even sometimes feet of paper.
Sometimes just by putting together all of the medical records from a patient from all of the different places that they have been seen and really digging through all of the details, you can find information that might be able to help lead to a diagnosis.
Anastasia Wise is the national coordinator of the network. She says patients also get an intensive 1-week evaluation where they're seen by different specialists who can discuss what they're finding. Then comes the more experimental stuff.
It's really taking cutting-edge research techniques and applying them to these patients that have typically received all of the standard clinical testing that's available by the time they come to the Undiagnosed Diseases Network.
We're talking detailed genome sequencing that most doctors don't have access to. And if a genetic anomaly is found, another lab can model it on real living things, specifically zebrafish and fruit flies, to see if it causes the same symptoms. Yes, zebrafish may help diagnose some patients. Still, success is far from guaranteed. Here's Wise again.
Their diagnosis rate is about 25% of individuals.
The NIH started working on undiagnosed diseases back in 2008, before it expanded into this new multi-hospital network. In the first 2 years, it saw 160 patients. About 40 were diagnosed, and it only found two completely new genetic diseases. The rest were just very rare. But John Phillips says he expects to find more. He's another doctor with a new clinical site at Vanderbilt.
We have perhaps 23,000 genes or so. But we only now know diseases that go with 4,000 of them. So logic would say there are 19,000 genes that could cause a disease, but no one has ever proven it.
He says now that doctors and labs across the country can collaborate, there's a better chance of diagnosing more.
And in many cases, that leads to something you can do about it.
Like finding ways to manage the symptoms. That's one reason 14-year-old Maggie Hall, who's one of the first patients accepted to the Vanderbilt site, wants to know what she has.
It would be good.
Maggie's been doing better recently. She can walk fine again, and she's gaining back some muscle weight. Her dad, Mike, says they're cautiously optimistic.
We've kind of gotten to the point now where we say, they're probably not going to find anything. She might just have Maggie Hall syndrome.
But he, too, is hoping for some new information that will help Maggie manage her disease, whatever it's called. Having her stay healthy, Mike says, is more important than having a name. For The Pulse, I'm Emily Siner.
The Pulse. We're talking about fresh starts today, and our next story takes us to Rhode Island, where more and more babies are being born dependent on the opioid drugs their mothers were addicted to during pregnancy. The baby's condition, called neonatal abstinence syndrome, sometimes requires hospital stays and powerful medication. Kristen Gourlay has the story of a newborn boy going through withdrawal and his young mother trying to make a new life for him in recovery.
Everybody
six, please. Ellen is riding up the elevator at Women and Infants Hospital in Providence on her way to see her newborn, Jonathan, who's in the nursery.
Grab him.
Ellen, we're not using her last name to protect her son, is 26. She's tall and blonde, wearing sweatpants and sneakers, and she's carrying a plastic bag full of bottles of breast milk she's pumped for her son. She hands it to the nurse, who lets her in. Now she's only got an hour or two to visit Jonathan before she has to catch her ride home. Home now is a place called Star Birth. It's a residential substance abuse treatment program for mothers with young children. And that's where Jonathan will join her when he's stable. Jonathan's been on a steadily decreasing dose of morphine to help him withdraw safely from the methadone he was exposed to in the womb. Methadone is an opioid that a doctor prescribes, and it's not supposed to get you high. Ellen takes methadone to curb cravings and keep from going into withdrawal herself from heroin. Ellen wheels Jonathan's bassinet into a private room where she can talk and cuddle with him. He's wrapped tight in a cotton blanket, and a tuft of brown hair is peeking out from the bundle. For now, he's calm and still, and that's a relief.
He makes little squeaks, too. There he goes. Yeah. Here he is.
Ellen knew he'd struggle soon after he was born.
This is my second son. My first son was also born when I was on methadone, so, you know, I had an idea of how it worked.
It is neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, and it's a collection of symptoms a baby develops going into withdrawal from the opioids his mother took while she was pregnant. Hours after he was born, Ellen says the doctors and nurses were looking for symptoms.
Yeah, they came in every 4 hours, and they would test his reflexes. They were asking me about, was he having any loose stool? Was he any spit up? He was having some tremors on Saturday, actually, the day after he was born. He was having some, tremor and kind of a lot, and that scared me.
So did the stiff limbs and fast breathing. So doctors started treatment. Low lighting, a quiet environment, tight swaddling. NAS babies have a hard time with a lot of stimuli. Plus, they gave him morphine to ease his symptoms.
And that was tough. I was emotional when I called and they told me they had started medicating him, but it's also, I don't want him to be uncomfortable.
As you might imagine, Ellen feels guilty about what Jonathan has gone through.
He's not an addict, he didn't choose to be on methadone, and the first thing they experience when they come into this world is detox. It's easy for me to kind of sit and feel sorry for myself, and but that doesn't help anybody. And I also know that I'm at a place, and I was at a place where if it wasn't for the methadone, it very well could have been something a whole lot worse, so.
It could have been heroin. Ellen has been in and out of treatment for addiction since high school. She stayed clean during her first pregnancy, but started using again as soon as her first son was born. It got so bad, authorities found her slumped and sedated at a bus stop, her baby in a stroller nearby.
The police, had to wake me up and then brought me to the office, to the DCYF office, and it was obvious that I was using something, and I wasn't allowed to leave with my son.
And because of DCYF, the Rhode Island Department of Children, Youth, and Families, her first son was adopted by a family Ellen says she now admires and appreciates. Losing her first son was a blow, but Ellen says it led to a wake-up call.
That is when I, finally was able to say, I don't want that, I don't want to live like that, and I never felt that desperation that I felt, that true desperation. I will do anything to stay clean. And that's something, I've said that in the past, but I've never really felt it. I felt like I'll do it as long as it's not uncomfortable, or I'll do it as long as it's not too hard. And it is uncomfortable and it is hard.
But Ellen says she's up to it. It is tough, but she says she needs the structure in her residential program, like the daily counseling sessions.
Monday through Friday, we have groups. They have a daycare right on the premises with amazing staff. There, we wake up in the morning and, get the kids breakfast, and you have your own room, your own bathroom.
Now it's time to wheel Jonathan back to the nursery. Before Ellen leaves, pediatrician Jean Zeider pulls her into a room to talk discharge planning.
Did you want to chat for a minute?
Sure.
I always like to try to touch.
Soon, Jonathan will be ready to go home.
So we're at the point now where we stop the morphine today,
mm-hmm.
And then we'll want to watch him 2 to 3 days
okay.
off of the morphine to make sure that he's doing fine off of that.
Okay. They had said Friday or Saturday, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm not, sure.
But Jonathan may still be uncomfortable for a few weeks or more. And for that, Ellen will be sent home with another medication for him, phenobarbital, which doctors say is usually for seizures, but seems to help babies going through withdrawal. Ellen knows she's also got a long road ahead to stay clean, to deal with the guilt.
I feel like I've just been able to begin to let go of some of that guilt. There's a lot of people out there that would hear my story, and the fact that I'm sitting here saying all this holding a baby, not everyone understands, and I get that.
She says she's trying to do the right things now for herself and for Jonathan.
Okay. All right, very nice.
She says goodbye
to
him and takes the elevator back to the lobby, peels off her visitor badge, and heads outside into the waiting white van. For The Pulse, I'm Kristen Gourlay.
Kristen Gourlay is a healthcare reporter with Rhode Island Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. It's the beginning of a new year, a time we usually set aside to reinvent ourselves, right? Perhaps you're finally ready to use that juicer you got for Christmas, or the one you got the Christmas before. Or maybe you want to use that treadmill that's been covered in clothes for years. But becoming that amazing person always proves to be really tricky. Joining us now to talk about that aspect of human behavior is Shankar Vedantam. He's a science correspondent for NPR and host of the podcast The Hidden Brain. Shankar, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We spend a lot of time studying ourselves these days and our behavior. Pretty much any decision we make at any time of the day has been studied. How we buy things, how we motivate ourselves, how we concentrate. So we know all these things, but my question is, are we getting any better? It still seems like we eat too much, we drink too much, we purchase all the wrong things, we behave reprehensibly online. So are we getting anywhere with all of this knowledge?
Well, that's an excellent question, Maiken, because I think it actually goes to something that's a really insightful idea, which is that merely knowing how we operate and why we do the things we do is not sufficient to change the things that we do. So merely knowing that I'm going to be tempted by candy and unhealthy food doesn't stop me from being tempted by candy and unhealthy food. There's an extra step that's required, which is the step of actual effort, where you actually say, this is something I've observed about myself. This is something I understand about myself. I'm actually going to make the changes that are necessary.
So know thyself is not enough, I guess, if we're not doing anything about it.
That's exactly right. You know, a few years ago, I was speaking with Dan Gilbert. He's a psychologist at Harvard, and he wrote a wonderful book called Stumbling on Happiness, maybe about 5-10 years ago. And the book is really about all the different ways in which human beings make choices that they think will make them happy, but in many ways do not make them happy. So it was looking at all the ways in which we are very poor judges of what will make us happy 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road. And I asked Dan at the end of our interview, so you've done all of this research on why it is people make decisions that don't make them happy. Do you make decisions yourself now that make you happy all the time? And he said, no, I don't. I make the same decisions as everybody else. I just understand why I'm unhappy now as opposed to actually changing what I do. So there is that step between understanding and actually acting on what you understand.
Is it possible, in your opinion, to improve oneself? You know, a lot of times I go to bed every night and somehow I think, tomorrow I'm going to do better. Tomorrow I'm going to eat less. I'm going to go out for that run. And then I do the exact same thing, as you were just saying about Dan Gilbert. So is it possible to really change things about ourselves in fundamental ways?
I think it's absolutely possible to change things about ourselves in fundamental ways. It just requires planning and persistence and effort. In many ways, it's like learning a musical instrument or learning a new language. Is it possible to learn a musical instrument or a new language? Absolutely, it's possible, but it requires planning, persistence, and effort. So the moment you slack up, the moment you let the effort go, you start sliding back down the hill. So the difficulty in this is actually not the insight step. The insight step is actually interesting and fun, and you learn things about yourself, and that's interesting. The difficult part is the effort step, where you take what you have learned, you take the insight, and you actually change what it is that you're doing.
Why is that so hard? There's always that little voice inside of our head that seems to undermine those plans. You know, the little voice in your head doesn't say, yay, get up and go to the gym. It says, no, stay in bed. You're tired, you know? So why is that? Why does our mind seem to undermine us?
Well, our minds undermine us because in many ways, our minds are not designed for the kind of lives that we are leading today. So my mind was not designed for the fact that I would live into my 40s, because for most of my ancestral history, you know, people like me would be dead by the time they were 30. And so the idea that you would actually have to wake up and train yourself to go to the gym and lead a healthy life because you're aiming to live to 80 or 90 or 100, that was unthinkable 100,000 years ago because no one lived to be 100, or very, very, very few people lived to be 100. So our brains, which were designed in this crucible of evolution, were designed to solve very specific kinds of problems. And the specific kinds of problems we were dealing with were really avoid predators, find calories so that you can stay alive, and reproduce. So these are the sort of basic fundamental things that our brains were designed to do. And when you fast forward into the 21st century, it becomes vitally important to eat fewer calories rather than more calories. It becomes vitally important to burn energy rather than conserve energy. And in many ways, this is exactly the opposite of what our brains were designed to do over hundreds of thousands of years. And so it's not surprising that the algorithms in the hidden brain are still trying to solve the problems that we had 100,000 or 200,000 years ago, even though the world we live in today has changed dramatically. Our brains have not evolved at the same pace that our civilization and our environments have evolved.
Shankar Vedantam is a science correspondent for NPR, and he hosts the podcast The Hidden Brain. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about fresh starts today. And what Shankar said about sustained effort certainly comes to play in our next story. Steve Clark always wanted to do something heroic. He's a sixth grade teacher in Philadelphia. That's everyday heroic, perhaps. But he wanted to be more like a Greek hero. Trouble is, he's never been athletic. He has asthma. He says he's totally uncoordinated. He says when his twin brother was playing varsity basketball in high school, he was doing Model United Nations. So when he turned 31 last year, he decided it was time to give this a shot. He signed up for the Philadelphia Marathon. He trained some in the summer, but his efforts were lackluster. But still, he showed up on race day determined to finish. Here's what happened.
I started running with a friend of mine, and she suggested I take on a mantra. Hers was something like, my heart is strong, my mind is strong, my body's strong. And I just kept saying to myself, just get there, just don't die. You know, God, don't let me die. Amen. And so I kept saying that to myself over and over again. And it went okay for the first couple miles, but at mile three, I see this guy with a sign that reads two knee replacements on his back because he's passing in front of me. So I get a little demoralized, but at mile six, my brother comes out and he starts running with me. And while he's running, he's walking, I'm running. And he stays with me and he gives me some advice. He says, run for a song, walk for a song, run for a song, walk for a song. And we get close to mile 13 and it's about 3 hours in, a little bit past that actually. And he says, do you think you can do it? Do you think you can finish? And I say, I think I can. And I'm pumped up that I'm finished half and I'm ready to go. And I start into the second half of the marathon and I look around and all the people that were surrounding me are now gone. And I'm like the only one that's going to finish the full thing. They had finished the half, which is still incredible. So I start the second half of the marathon and I get to about mile 17 and there's this this van with blinking lights. And I ask someone what it is and they say that's called the lag bus. It's about a mile behind me. But what it is it picks up people who don't finish the marathon in 7 hours or less. I hadn't realized that that was the time limit. So I start pushing ahead and cut out the bathroom breaks I was planning on and keep moving forward. But at about mile 19 or 20, my legs kind of cut out and stop working as well. And I can't even run at that point. And my brother's tracking me. He's telling me, like, you know, you're slowing down. You need to keep ahead of pace. And I tell him I can't run. I just got to keep moving. And at about mile 21, this guy pulls up on a tricycle next to me, the cyclist. And he says, Steve, right, you're now officially the last person in the marathon. And I have 5 miles left to go, and I can barely move my legs. And I'm starting to think this was a bad idea, and I'm completely demoralized because, like, I had 21 miles done. I just wanted to finish, you know? And I couldn't believe they weren't going to let me finish. And the lag bus is 3 feet behind me. So I ask the guy in the van, like, you know, I thought I had 7 hours to finish. It's not 7 hours yet. He's like, yeah, you do. You're just slightly ahead of pace. So I asked him for a bottle of water, and he gave me one, and I kept moving. And I moved as fast as I could, and I got to mile 22 and mile 23. And at mile 24, a street cleaner pulls in front of the lag bus and pulls in front of me, and the lag bus pulls up next to me, and my heart sinks because I think they're going to pick me up. But the guy that's driving says to me, just keep going. I'll take care of it. And he cuts the guy off, the street cleaner off, and lets me keep going. And so I moved to mile 25, and it's killing me, and I'm moving as fast as I can, and I'm not, you know, I know I'm behind pace, but I moved to mile 26, and I'm about to finish, and I hear the announcer say, ladies and gentlemen, there comes a time in every race when the last official marathoner crosses the line. And people are cheering, and I finish in 7 hours and 20 minutes, and I can't believe they let me finish. And I got to shake Mayor Nutter's hand, and he said, you know, I just wanted to stay till the very end. I went to sleep right after the marathon. I slept for, must have been 16 hours.
Steve Clark is a Philadelphia teacher, and he holds the proud title of last person to finish the 2015 Philadelphia Marathon. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Often, serious behavior change comes in the wake of a dramatic event when our current lifestyle catches up with us. That's what happened with a community of Buddhist monks in South Philadelphia. Their temple is located in a bustling part of that neighborhood, near car repair shops and building supply stores, but inside it's quiet and peaceful. The walls are painted in vibrant hues of red and orange, the floors are lined with thick carpets with intricate patterns, a giant golden Buddha statue gazes down from an elevated stage, and the monks just sit there in their orange robes, chanting in endless repetitions. In May of 2014, the chanting of head monk Paitun Phajantola almost came to an end.
One time, he said it just happened spontaneously. He didn't know what happened, but he got the tightness on his chest.
Phajantola is from Laos. He's 65 years old, a stocky man with a broad smile, a round shaved head, and a big belly. His English is limited, so Sutisha Giat Gosunkun, who worships at this temple, is translating for me.
And he got all the sweaty, so people in the temple brought him to the hospital, and he got diagnosed with a heart attack.
Sutisha is a nurse, and she told a former colleague, Brad Rosenfield, about what had happened to the monk.
Frankly, I was surprised because I always associate the lifestyle of a Buddhist monk with being stress-free and peaceful.
Rosenfield is a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, and he was intrigued by what he had heard, so he decided to investigate. He found out that the monks at the temple, there are six of them living upstairs on simple cots, get by solely on donations from community members, alms.
And the food that they donate is the food that they think is very special, of course, because they love and respect the monks. So the type of food that they think is very special is the type of thing they might bring to a party.
The community around the temple is mostly immigrants from Laos. Food is a big part of life and best in abundance.
Just an explosion of food, more food than anybody could possibly eat.
Some of the favorites include sweet, sticky rice, fried spring rolls, succulent pieces of pork. Sutisha Giat Gosunkun says some people bring food to the temple every day.
I have seen a lot of the fried stuff. I have seen a lot of the sweet stuff.
Coconut banana dessert and banana leaf, that's what she brought with her.
But it turns out food wasn't the only culprit. As Brad Rosenfield did more health detective work, he also learned that the monks spent most of their day meditating.
This is seated meditation. So with the combination of the unhealthy food, the sedentary lifestyle, in addition to the fact that we found that the monks did not have insurance, health insurance, so they weren't getting regular health care, this was like the perfect storm for cardiovascular disease.
Rosenfield enlisted the help of his colleagues and students at the College of Osteopathic Medicine. They volunteered their time to get the monks enrolled in Medicare. They observed what kinds of foods people were bringing to the temple and talked to them about healthier options. They made posters with pictures to get around language barriers. Rosenfield was worried at first about how people would react, but he says out of love for the monks, most people wanted to do whatever it took to keep them healthy.
We've moved from the fatty foods to more chicken, more fish, grilling and baking and boiling rather than frying, which is ubiquitous.
Rosenfield and his colleagues recently set up a health fair at the temple.
We have 150 shots today, so...
A huge pot of Vietnamese noodle soup bubbled in the corner. The air smelled deliciously of basil and lime. And people lined up for flu shots, diabetes screens, and blood pressure checks before sitting down for a bowl of pho. Temple President Kuni Villafan says this is a trusted place, and it creates a bridge between separate worlds.
It's two different generations talking to each other with different language. So this is where they found comfort of coming to talk about their problem.
Villafan is alluding to some of the strong beliefs held by older members of the temple, which can make buying into Western medicine difficult. It's something Brad Rosenfield has come across frequently.
If you're having a heart problem or a stomach problem or even you have a headache, it might be because the spirits are angry. You may have offended the spirits in some way.
Rosenfield says he works around this by saying that the spirits are offering a solution or an opportunity in the shape of a few nice people in white coats. And the monks have been responding. Here is head monk Paitun Vajontala with translator Sutisha.
He said that after Dr. Brad came in and teach him how to change the way he eat, so now before he big on the sticky rice, now he eat more brown rice, and he say that he also recommended not eat to the high-fat diet, so he cut down all the high-fat food and eat more vegetables, and also he do more the walking, the exercise.
Rosenfield beams as the monk talks about his progress. They chat for a minute more, and then Vajontala has to leave for his first primary care doctor's appointment since getting health insurance.
Thank you. Good luck.
Good luck.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Yes.
Bong Ni.
Rosenfield's work at the temple is picking up international interest. He recently spoke about it at a conference in Thailand where monks are experiencing similar health issues. He says getting the South Philly monks into exercising and nutrition has had a ripple effect. Since they are beloved role models, community members have started to embrace the new mantra of healthy living. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about new beginnings. A lot of times when we're trying to eat healthier, our decisions are based on studies we read about. Perhaps you're sipping green tea and avoiding prosciutto right now. But how reliable is that research? Aaron Carroll writes about health research. He is a professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, and he recently discussed a study that found that there is no difference in terms of health impact between honey, sugar, and artificial sweeteners. I asked him what his issues were with this study.
It's not a big study. It's just, you know, a couple of tens of people looked at for 2 weeks, I believe, on different kinds of sweeteners. And that may sound bad. Like, why would we assume that if we just look at, you know, some small number of people and just follow them for a couple of weeks, that we can make definitive assessments upon, you know, whether things are healthy or not? But that's what we do all the time. And I think a lot of what, you know, my column was about was that this actually is a pretty good study. I mean, it's a randomized controlled trial, which already makes it amongst the better studies that you're ever going to see in nutrition. But the vast, vast majority of studies that are done upon which we decide what is healthy or not, or what we should be eating, are very small studies with very few people over very short periods of time. And I think it's problematic to make big leaps and assume that we can make really big generalizations about how people should be eating off of this type of very small research.
Why is it so hard to do bigger studies that go for a long amount of time?
Well, if you've ever been on a diet, you know that even when you are dedicated to it, it's very hard to stick to it for a long period of time. And that's when you're already predisposed to really go for it. If you're just a subject in a research study, the idea that you're going to radically change your eating for a long period of time without some kind of major inducement, it's just not going to happen. It's also very expensive to do big randomized controlled trials. When we do them in drugs, usually the pharmaceutical industry is investing the millions, if not billions of dollars that we need. It's very hard to get public funding to do big nutrition studies. And to be honest with you, it's not in the food industry's best interest to pony up that money. For one reason, they don't have to prove that their food is essentially healthy in order for people to eat it. People eat it just because it's food. And even when they do pony up the money, often people will then accuse them of biasing the research, or they don't like the results. In this case, this study was actually funded in part by, I think it was the Honey Board. I'm sure they weren't pleased with the results, and I doubt they'll be funding research like this in the future.
A lot of restaurants have been posting calorie counts on their menus. We know a lot more about the choices we have. Is that helpful?
Ironically, no. In fact, there's been a lot of research looking at posting of calorie counts. And the truth of the matter is that even when people notice them and they don't, there's almost no evidence that shows that they change their behavior. New York, for instance, has had calorie counts on many menus for years, and we've seen no change in how people are eating.
It seems almost as if there is so much desperation around this issue of obesity, which is getting worse all the time, that everybody just wants to do something, whether it's actually working or not.
I think that's very accurate. I think in medicine, that's often the case, and sometimes in public health as well. We need to do something, and so we want to do it right now, regardless of whether it's going to work or not. But Americans are eating fewer calories today than they have in the past. And obesity actually has been leveling off in the most recent years. But that doesn't mean that we should just continue on the same course, even if there's evidence that it's not going to work, just because doing something makes us feel good.
What are some interventions you've seen that perhaps could work?
So there have been some studies of other things. For instance, there was a study published not too long ago where customers were randomized to actually just be asked by servers, would you like a smaller portion of a starchy side dish? And it turns out that like a third of people said yes, even when they weren't paying less for it. Another study looked at changing the menus, not the calorie counts, but changing menus of children's menus to put healthier food more prominently and to make the pictures the healthier options, or to make the healthier options the default. And those changes also resulted in parents ordering more healthily for their children. There are other things we could try. But it sometimes just feels that we are on this train of menu labeling and calorie counts, and that's going to be the solution that's going to fix things. And I'd say there's almost less evidence for that than for other things we might try.
Aaron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aaron Carroll is a professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. He writes about health research on his blog, The Incidental Economist. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Some people who desperately need a fresh start can do nothing but wait. wait, and hope to stay alive. 15,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for liver transplants, and how long they'll be waiting depends on where in the country they are living. So some patients relocate, hoping for better chances. Karen Chakurji followed one young man as he left Boston in search of a new liver.
When I first met Seth Doraswamy last summer, he was holed up in his parents' house in Belmont, a suburb just outside of Boston. He had puffy cheeks, wide eyes, and shuffled around slowly in a big gray hoodie. This is the other room. We walked toward the dining room, past framed photographs of Seth, his siblings, and their kids. White lacy curtains covered the windows, and two fluffy dogs bounced around. We sat down, and he told me about his life in Italy.
Before all of this happened, I was considered a builder and a stonemason.
He had been living in Genoa for the past 5 years, close to his wife's family, building homes.
Then this is one of the projects we were working on before I left. Lots of stone walls and cement mixers.
But while he showed me these photos of his physically demanding job, he struggled just to sit up straight.
Bricks in between each one of them.
Seth was born with a liver disease called biliary atresia. It basically means the liver is not filtering bile the way it's supposed to. At 11 weeks old, he had a risky procedure done that saved his life. For years, he took antibiotic after antibiotic to prevent infections. But in December of 2014, at 32 years old, the disease caught up with him again.
We were working on a big house. I was working with a lot of guys. One of them one day just said, you know, your eyes are really yellow.
He was hospitalized for a couple weeks, and in January of 2015, he came back to Boston to be near his longtime doctor at Mass General Hospital. But Massachusetts, it turns out, is not the best place to be if you need a new liver.
When my doctor said, we may think about sending you out to Indiana, I was kind of shocked.
Getting on a list in another state is not so simple. Entering the world of medical tourism meant leaving his doctor at Mass General Hospital, meeting a whole new team, going through extensive tests, and all the while dealing with an obscene amount of paperwork. He did go out to Indiana for 2 weeks in June, but it didn't work out, and he returned to Boston still needing a liver. I asked him to keep an audio diary if he traveled elsewhere, and he said sure. He thought Wisconsin might be next. But on August 17th, I got an update.
I had to postpone my appointment in Wisconsin, cancel my reservations for the flights. Then all of a sudden, I found myself booking flights for Florida, finding a place to stay in Jacksonville.
An appointment opened up at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, and he bought a one-way ticket.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I have an appointment with Adam.
If you're wondering what's in Florida that's not in Massachusetts, the answer is it's complicated. Since doctors started transplanting organs successfully back in the 50s, geography has played a key role. Organs are time-sensitive. The average liver lasts about 6 hours after being procured from a donor. The closer the match, the better. In the 80s, the National Transplant Organization, called UNOS, divided the country into 11 regions. Then, in 2002, they implemented something called a MELD score, just for livers. It rates how sick a patient is. Today, a combination of your MELD score and location determines your place in line. The idea is to get the sickest patients transplanted first, but because some regions average transplants at lower scores, meaning you don't have to be as sick, people who can leave home to get on lists elsewhere.
And it's really tragic because the organs should be able to go to the patients wherever they live and not make the patients relocate.
David Mulligan is the chief of transplantation and immunology at Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut. For the past couple of years, he's been working on a proposal with UNOS to divide the country into fewer regions.
And the idea is that it's not really fair for people to have to suffer and actually die compared to someone who may live a few states away and can get an organ much more easily.
Generally, centers in the Southeast and the Midwest transplant patients with lower scores than ones in the Northeast or along the West Coast. Researchers disagree about why this is the case and what to do about it. Reasons seem to shift depending on who you talk to. It's a tricky combination of factors that include average lifespan, organ donor rates, and healthcare access in each region. And because relocating is costly, Mulligan says, the current system leaves people who can't afford to move at a disadvantage.
We're all not available to have private jet waiting on standby to take us to whichever transplant center calls us the first to say, we've got a liver, come on out and have your transplant.
The point of the redistricting plan is to get patients transplanted around the same score everywhere. Regions would morph in shape and size to include more states. It would mean more sharing between states and more livers being flown around.
We're in a desperate situation in California. We're desperate.
Catherine Frenette is the medical director of liver transplantation at Scripps Green Hospital in San Diego, California.
I know the middle of the country is fighting hard against redistricting because they don't want to give up their livers. They're in their thoughts, well, everything's fine. We're transplanting people. We're getting livers when we need them. Why are we going to change it? Why should we ship our livers to California?
Some surgeons say redistricting will only change which patients die because there are only so many livers to go around. Some will have to wait longer. John Hundley is a transplant surgeon at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia.
I can say this without any shadow of a doubt. This redistricting, it would cause more Georgians to die and fewer New Yorkers to die. That's what would happen. I mean, there'd still be just as many deaths.
Hundley also admits, as many have, that everyone wants what's best for their patients. Whether redistricting is the answer or not, the current system entices patients to relocate. Patients like Seth Doraswamy.
I'm taking a lot of blood today.
After being in Florida for 2 weeks, the clinic agreed to put him on the wait list. He just needed to get approval from his insurance.
We heard back that they would cover my transplant here, which is a huge relief, so now it's just the waiting game. They just said, keep your phone charged, on loud as it can be, have a little backpack ready.
Then, a few weeks later, he got deathly ill. His MELD score shot up to 40, the highest it can be, and he went into the ICU.
Maybe close to around midnight, I heard a doctor come into the room, start talking to one of my nurses. He came over and just out of the blue announced to me, we may have a liver this evening. Being in the hospital already, I was just lying in bed and just started thinking inside my head, you know, maybe this is it.
On September 24th, around 3 o'clock in the morning, anesthesiologists came in to ready him for the surgery. When Seth came to, he was covered in tubes and wires and in a lot of pain. But even with the pain, he noticed positive changes almost immediately.
When I went to the bathroom after surgery, I almost wanted to cry because since I was a little boy, I only saw dark urine. And so when I saw clear urine, I jumped out of the bathroom like a 2-year-old boy and announced to my wife that I just peed normally for the first time in decades.
A couple months later, when I visit him in Boston, Seth looks like a different person. Gone are the puffy cheeks and the yellow eyes. He's laughing easily and tossing a ball around with Benji.
Baba, Yuki.
The amount of people traveling for liver transplants like Seth is unclear, but research shows travelers are 74% more likely to get a transplant than similar patients who stay put.
If I hadn't done that, then who knows what my fate would have been up here.
Where do you want me to go?
There's no way of knowing, of course, but one thing is clear. He's never been more excited about the future. For The Pulse, I'm Karen Chakurji.
The
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Joel Patterson is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.